Matt Robeson, Beyond Politics. And today, as protests over the war in Gaza between Israel and Hamas reignite and turn violent, former Congressman Paul Hodes and our Republican political consultant Alicia Preston and I talk about whether a line has been crossed and what universities that have been paralyzed for so long should do now. We also mark the historic passage of the foreign aid bill, which included long overdue money for Ukraine. And you'll want to hang around till the end when we ask whether our quote from Mitt Romney this week was a great one or the greatest one ever given. But we start off with the tsunami of Trump legal news, including yesterday's massive Supreme Court hearing, new indictments in Arizona, and Paul's evaluation as a former prosecutor of how effective this week's testimony in the New York trial really was. Also, a quick programming note, next week, you'll see our interview show drop on Tuesday rather than new shows on Monday and Wednesday, and you may only see two episodes a week from us in some weeks during May rather than three, because we're trying to create a little bit of room because we're working on some new projects that we're really excited to bring to you. And with that, let's pick it up with a look at how well this week's prosecution of Donald Trump really went. So, Paul, as always, this week in Trump, let's once again lean on your experience as a prosecutor. I want you to get me and all of us out of We Are Democrats brain. Actually, I'd like to get Alicia into We Are a Democrat brain. Alicia, come on. Can I interest you in riding this donkey?
The basement has been furnished, especially
for you. Nice.
Right. I'm hanging with Viola, the escaping elephant, still at the moment. But
okay, so Paul, walk us through the big testimony this week from David Pecker. As we record this, it's ongoing. I know we're never going to catch up to real time, but as a former prosecutor, what was your assessment of the effectiveness of that testimony for the prosecution and overall how the trial's going?
Okay. So first of all, we'll put aside the fact that everybody has to keep a straight face when referring to David Pecker in connection with Donald Trump. I'll briefly talk about the crime that we're dealing with. We're dealing with falsification of business records. And the basis for this prosecution is that Trump covered up an illegal scheme by falsifying his business records to classify in his business records what were what should have been campaign expenses as legal expenses. Falsifying business records is a misdemeanor unless it's in furtherance of some other crime.
I see.
In New York State, there is a statute which makes preventing or promoting the election of any person a crime. So in other words, one of the elements the prosecution has to prove in order to have a felony conviction is that whatever Trump and his cronies did in connection with falsifying the business records was to further the crime of essentially interfering in the election. So enter Pecker, so to speak. So David Pecker is the former publisher of AMI.
I'm wondering if there's a label above explicit that I can put on this episode.
National Enquirer. It's his name. What can he do? He was born with it. He used it. So here's what we know now from Pecker's testimony. While Trump was a candidate for president, not yet president, he and Pecker had been very close friends. He and Pecker get together with Michael Cohen at Mar-a-Lago, and they hatch a scheme that either Pecker proposes and they agree, that three of them agree, that Pecker will be the eyes and ears of the campaign. He will find potentially damaging stories about Trump. He will catch them and kill them. And that will be one of the things the Inquirer does. And in addition, the Inquirer, he'll also allow Trump and Cohen to use the Inquirer as a mouthpiece for going after other of Trump's presidential rivals. Remember, he's in a primary with Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. So we saw all those headlines about Ted Cruz eats babies, Marco Rubio's father was Castro's butler, whatever they were. Those were all part of their idea about the Inquirer helping Trump with the election. But the catch and kill scheme was particularly relevant to what is happening in the courtroom, because it is the crime. The crime is they agree to find these damaging stories, to use money to cover them up, which otherwise would have damaged Trump's electoral prospects.
I'm trying to put myself into the mindset of a juror, and hearing this for the first time, the idea that a candidate would have a friend in the media and that friend would say, I'm going to help you. I'm going to put all the resources of my publication behind your candidacy. That does not in itself sound like a crime to me. In fact, that's basically the plot of Citizen Kane. I'm not going to spoil the other secret of Citizen Kane, although if you haven't seen it at this point, what's wrong with you? But the idea, it's that old, the idea that a big publisher with a big megaphone, William Randolph Hearst, whoever it is, could decide, this is essentially what Rupert Murdoch did, is get full bore behind Trump. So why is that a crime to sit down? I mean, Paul, if you ran for president right now and this podcast were just slightly bigger, I would go on the air and promote your candidacy every day. That doesn't feel like a crime to me.
The idea is that if you're interfering in an election and you agree to do something to interfere in an election, i.e. to prevent or promote the candidacy of somebody, it goes from innocent to something else. And then when you cover it up by mischaracterizing your business records, which is the cover-up of that scheme, by misclassifying them as legal expenses when they are in fact should have been reported as campaign expenses, you commit a crime. So, simple question. What if Trump had simply said, I don't care about all these false stories. These are a false story. Because he denies, of course, having sex with Stormy Daniels, right? So if he had simply said, all these payments are campaign expenses, I wanted to kill stories, and they're legitimate campaign expenses, what would the state have charged him with? They wouldn't have charged him.
Can I just read this back to you? So what you're saying is, falsifying business records, there are 34 instances here, 34 pieces of paper, as the defense attorney put it, where Trump made payments, falsified records, saying, I'm paying legal expenses, whereas in fact, he's paying for hush money payments, campaign-related
expenditures.
Right, because of this scheme that they hatched. And what Pecker's testimony established was, yes, There was a scheme that was an underlying crime. So from a prosecutor's standpoint, how did it go?
I think Pecker is doing a fine job. I don't know that Trump really appreciates what the prosecution is doing by leading with David Pecker instead of leading with, here's what Trump did with the paperwork. Here's what Trump and Cohen did with the records. They're leading with the good stuff from David Pecker and establishing, yes, there was this scheme that the three of them hatched. And then we're going to go backwards. Cohen is going to testify and basically corroborate what Pecker says about the meetings and about the scheme and about all the transfers and about all the money. And then the prosecution is going to end probably after all the good stuff with, here's the paperwork. And here's what the paperwork says. They're probably their last witnesses are going to be a documents expert and a paralegal from the DA's office who will testify to doing some work to put together various phone records. Because one of the things they asked Pecker was for his phone number. And the reason why he asked the witness for his phone number, because they have the records showing phone calls between Cohen and Trump, between Pecker and Trump. And then they're going to also show that when Trump was in the White House, he and Pecker were continuing with this scheme because they were having very frequent phone calls. So at the very end of the trial, the prosecution will probably introduce all that boring stuff. Here's the 34 pieces of paper. Here's what they mean. Here's the phone records. All that stuff, which is frankly not the most exciting kind of testimony, will be at the end. So when the jury is going into the jury room after the closing arguments, the last thing they will have is all that paperwork on their mind that connects all the other testimony they've heard.
So one more for you here. It sounds like the story that prosecutors are trying to tell here is, this isn't a record-keeping case. It's a conspiracy case. It's a scheme case. And so if you believe this story, if you believe that there was an agreement, a conspiracy, then as soon as you see the fake pieces of paper, you must convict.
Yeah, these guys agreed they were going to kill stories in order to prevent or promote from his candidacy. In this case, promote his candidacy by killing the bad stories.
A couple takeaways. I think what the prosecution's doing, and I think it's smart, is laying two foundations. One, solidifying by the testimony of David Pecker that this was not to protect Donald Trump's marriage. This was not to protect his private life or any embarrassment in that respect. This was to protect him politically. And that's the key. That's key foundation for this case. The other thing is they're using David Pecker to lay the foundation that whatever Michael Cohen tells you, actually, there's some basis in fact, because that's the defense's mission to say that Michael Cohen's the key witness, right? So Michael Cohen's a liar. Michael Cohen's this. David Pecker gave value to the fact that Michael Cohen was in these rooms. He was the contact, the conduit, if you will, for a lot of the activities going on and the stories being placed. And so he kind of preemptorily gave credibility to Michael Cohen before he testifies, which I think was a smart thing for them to do. Now, I happen to be someone who is a little skeptical about what you brought up at first. Is it really a crime to work with a media publication to have them favor you?
Right. If I'm the Trump attorney, that's my right. That's my story here, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a huge threat. The business, the paperwork. Yeah, that seems pretty simply that they lied on paperwork. But to raise it to a felony, you need this underlying issue. And to me, particularly as someone who has worked comms for politicians, we worked with publications all the time. We knew what papers were favorable. You knew what publishers were going to do op-eds for you. And you knew if you were going to get endorsed before you got endorsed, and you might even feed them some stuff on the other guy. That's just how it works. And so I kind of think that's a stretch.
Yeah. But have you ever in your career,
don't admit to anything, Alicia, sneaky prosecutor,
have you ever in your career as a political operative and communication specialist made an explicit agreement with the publisher of one of those newspapers that you may have known was in favor of you, made an explicit agreement to run favorable articles for your candidate, to run unfavorable articles against somebody based on your explicit agreement that the purpose of it was to help your candidate? Has that ever happened to you?
No, but I'm sure it has others. And as to whatever an explicit agreement is, David Pecker says there was this agreement. They never put anything in writing. It was a handshake. That happens everywhere.
Uh-huh. But what about it's the payments, the catch and kill payments? Because what I, as Alicia's attorney, I'm just a simple country lawyer. But it seems to me that my client, Alyssa Preston, has never entered in. I'm going to stop this metaphor now. I'm not Foghorn Leghorn. Jeez.
Foghorn Leghorn.
It sounded a bit, but that's
what it was a good Foghorn Leghorn.
Guys. You know what just dawned on me? Maybe I am Foghorn Leghorn. None of the kids know who that is. But Alicia's never entered into an agreement where she facilitated payments through a publisher that her candidate, in fact, paid for. So that I see what you mean in all of this. It's sort of the secret sauce that turns this. It's not a Big Mac until you add the secret sauce, right? It's just a burger. And I think what's complicated about this case is you explained it very well, Paul. The question to me is, will the jury get the secret sauce? Let's take a break. We'll be right back. Because it's a two-part chain of reasoning. You have to have both parts. You have the falsification of records, which is a misdemeanor, and you have the conspiracy, which on its own it's kind of a crime, but it also has this feeling of sort of business as usual. You have to link the two together to have it turn into a felony, and maybe the prosecution can make that link for the jury, and maybe they can. Hey, right. Speaking of Trump legal trouble, let's just quickly touch on the breaking news from recording this on Thursday, so it was late last night, of a whole slew of new indictments in Arizona. All of the big wigs in the Trump 2020 campaign, the Evildoers Incorporated, Mick Mulvaney, Mark Meadows, Mickey Mouse. Maybe Mick Mulvaney was not indicted. Rudy Giuliani sure was. John Eastman sure was. Trump unindicted co-conspirator number one. This feels to me like the effect of it is legally, it's like prosecutors across the country are creating horcruxes. So if the Supreme Court hearing happening today goes insanely and somehow Ginny Thomas gets her way and it's, like, oh, presidents can do whatever they want. And Trump is immune from the Jack Smith prosecution here. There are now multiple horcruxes. There are multiple state prosecutions going on. It feels like a big deal.
I'm wondering why it took them so long. I mean, a lot of these Trump cases, they took years. They had to take years. Trump's been dragging them out. That's on him. But this is a new indictment on these guys. And look, I don't know if they did something wrong or not. It certainly sounds like they did. We've been following the fake electors things for years now. But I do wonder why it's taken them 3.5 years to come up with this indictment. It doesn't sound like you would need to. And that's not in defense of what they did. But at some point, it is going to look like what Trump claims it is, which I don't think it is, a witch hunt. But if this keeps happening all these years later, it's going to at some point look that way. You mentioned on the Supreme Court thing, I don't think in a million years the Supreme Court is going to just blanketly say presidents can do whatever they want. Go shoot your political opponent. Go use SEAL Team 6 to kill Joe Biden. I just don't see a scenario where that is. There are scenarios, legal scholars have been saying, where it may not be as black and white as yes or no. It could be on these counts. It could have been in the process of his job. On these, it may not have been in the process of his job. Go back to lower courts and have them look at this. So this may not be over as quickly as we all hope it is, so we can move on with what I think is proper prosecution of Donald Trump.
Right. The other possibility is that they could essentially construct out of thin air a new legal test to apply to the judge, Tanya Chutkan, in the case, where she would have to essentially cross a bar in order to be able to apply the charges. That's another way they could gum up the works. And it seems like there is some momentum for doing that inside the Supreme Court. So maybe that raises even further the significance of this. Paul, I have a technical question for you. Trump is an unindicted co-conspirator. Can he be promoted to a fully indicted co-conspirator?
Sure, they could indict him.
But they're just not right now.
They're not right now. And remember, this kind of prosecution is, there are at least 6 other states in addition to Arizona where all this happened. This is an octopus with shoes, and they could start floating down to the bottom of the sea.
I'm still working my way through that metaphor.
I think
it's brilliant. No, I actually love it. It's so weird. My almost 11-year-old tried to institute a burn on his sister, and he said something to the effect of, some people think an ocean is a stream, but to you, it's just an ocean. And there was a diss in there somewhere, but he angled it. But I think what he came up with is actually better. It's brilliant. And now we've got another aquatic metaphor. All right.
It's an octopus's garden.
Speaking of a day in the life, it's been a rough day in the life of the president of Columbia University. It's actually been a rough year. And now the issues are spreading far and wide. Alicia, you wrote an entire article on this. It was excellent. Walk us through it.
Columbia, now it's spread to Yale and Harvard and Berkeley and even Ohio State. But it does fascinate me that it tends to be the more elite schools that these things pop up. What's 10 days ago as pro-Palestinian rallies, or that was a claimed intent to sympathize with the Palestinian people suffering, has now turned into full-on anti-Semitic Jewish hate, wipe Israel off the face of the planet protests at these campuses. And what bothers me is, well, Columbia did. Other colleges have now done it, but Columbia was the first. What they did to protect Jewish students, who, mind you, this isn't just, you know, save Israel, stop bombing Gaza, ceasefire. This is October 7th will be every day for you. This is Al-Qassam's next target with an arrow pointing to a group of Jewish students. This is a Jewish journalist, student journalist at Yale, got surrounded along with her partner and by dozens of Palestinian protesters, anti-Israel protesters, flipping her off. And then one stabbed her in the eye with a Palestinian flag and she had to be taken off in an ambulance. This is some serious bad crap. Support of Hamas. We are Hamas. And what Columbia's president said was, to protect the Jewish students, of which, mind you, 22% of Columbia are Jewish students. That's a huge number. We're going to go remote classes rather than tell the kids, get the F off the lawn. Stop the hate. This is not protesting. This is not constitutionally protected protesting. This is ensuing violence and hate and not allowed on our private property campuses. And expel them if they don't. Arrest them if they don't. Instead, they told the Jewish kids to stay home and let the haters spread their hate and let them spread their violent language. It's dangerous. There was a ruckus with police in New York City. 133 people arrested because they were throwing bottles and other projectiles at police. It's out of control. And to who is to blame is the college leadership at these elite institutions who are letting it happen at the great devaluation of the Jewish students on those campuses. And actually all Americans who do not in any way, shape or form want to be part of spreading hatred. And by the way, the absolute ignorance coming out of these elite schools from these students and some faculty boggles my mind.
I want to talk about your article for a second. You take the perspective of a parent of a college student. And I want to ask the protesters, who are some of the most privileged people in the world. You are on elite campuses. You live a very cloistered, very protected existence. And many of you have the means to afford these places. You had the means growing up to do all the college prep and extracurriculars and fancy prep schools that put you in a position to get there. But at these elite institutions, many of your fellow students did not. You care about social justice. What about the justice for the first generation college students, the people who worked jobs, minimum wage jobs to save up for college? What about the strivers? You have an issue that's so important to you that you feel like they all need to disrupt their exploration, their coming of age, their training, their shot at opportunity because of the issue that you care about. And I'm not demeaning the importance of the issue. But what if these students felt that, oh no, your issue should take a back seat. Your education should take a back seat to their issue. What if their issue were Ukraine, where there's been at least the same scale of death, of destruction? What if your issue is Sudan? What if your issue is any one of the other places in the world where there's injustice, where there's war? Your article reminded me so much, Alicia, of FDR's four freedoms. And freedom of speech is one of them. But freedom from fear is another. And it seems very clear to me that the students who are engaged in going over the line in these protests have either thought about the rights of their fellow students or they haven't. And I'm not sure which is worse.
What you're talking about is actually a movement on one of these social media platforms that includes a hashtag I will not share. And it is a Palestinian-American woman started it back in January or maybe earlier, where she is demanding that her followers go onto the posts of influencers who might be posting about makeup or juice or a candy bar. But if they're influencers with more than X amount of followers, demand they weigh in on the Israeli-Gaza conflict. And if they do not, you cancel them. And one of the biggest influencers with makeup products on Instagram has canceled all her accounts because it got so flooded with people just bullying her, demanding she answer. Why do I have to weigh in on this? She peddles makeup for a living. Demand, and she isn't Palestinian, she isn't Israeli, she's just an influencer. But this is what they're doing. They are bullying people into silence, submission, or acquiescence. And if you do not weigh in on something you may know nothing about, and you do not do so in my favor, in the same way that I feel about it, we will destroy you in some way or another. In this case, on Instagram, it's taken away their careers. It's a nasty bullying generation that does it in the name of peace and righteousness, which is bizarre, but that's what they do it under.
So, well, can I ask you about a specific aspect of this? Because you're not only a former member of Congress, boy, it sounds like Hair Club for Men, you're also a client. But you were on an elite Ivy League campus during Vietnam War protests.
Right.
What's the difference here? Let's take a break. We'll be right back.
We're dealing with one of the most morally fraught dilemmas of the modern era. In the 60s, the United States was perpetrating a war overseas. We just thought it shouldn't be fought. One of the differences is we didn't have social media. A protest spread all over the United States on campuses everywhere. But we don't see the kind of amplified vitriol against our fellows that Alicia just talked about. That's one great distinction. And there was no anti-Semitism in the protests. There was no transference of the issue to some other religiously affiliated group. We were protesting what the government of the United States was doing in our name. Now, protesters here, some of them are saying the same thing. We have a right to peaceably assemble in this country. These assemblies have turned into something in many instances other than peaceful assemblies. I was at Dartmouth College when students took over the administration building. They staged the sit-in. This was years after it had happened at Columbia, which always seems to be in the vanguard because you got New York and you got all those liberals and everything. Columbia always seems to come first. At Dartmouth College, we were much later than Columbia when people took over the administration building. I was outside on the steps of the administration building when the college authorities had called in the National Guard, who came with what was then the Humvees and arms and basically forced their way into the administration building, pulled all those protesters out, and prosecuted them for trespassing. The protests did not involve, as far as I could tell, in the protests that I was involved with, did not involve the kind of harassment of other students and the targeting of other students that we're seeing in these protests. When the protests turn from a protest against what a government is doing and we want to demonstrate and peacefully assemble to targeting students or faculty and harassing, bullying, intimidating, and assaulting, then it's turned into something else.
I recall vividly when there were protesters targeting you, Paul, as a member of Congress. There were protesters who would show up to your home. There were protesters who would show up to your offices. And we took the approach, as long as they were respectful, peaceful, and protesting, exercising their right of free speech, when they were in your offices, as long as they weren't disrupting the business of the office on behalf of other people who also have rights and freedoms, we not only accommodated them, you brought them Dunkin' Donuts. If anyone had threatened your family, had threatened one of the people in your offices, the police would have been there faster than you can say boo. I hate the expression, someone is overthinking it. Rarely do I encounter in the world that people are applying too much thought to problems. Actually, thinking is generally in short supply. This is a case where I agree with both of you. I think that these college presidents are collectively overthinking this because they're getting caught up on a principle of free speech that they think is being hemmed in here. Whereas the answer is not at all. You have your right to swing your fists ends at my nose. Your right to free speech is absolutely untrammeled until you go too far. Would you say that telling a group of Jewish students to go back to Poland is going too far? That they should be the next target of terrorists is going too far? That sending a young person to the hospital is going too far? You drive around at 65 miles per hour, you can go wherever you want. If you go over the speed limit, you're going to get pulled over. And the fact that previously they've cleared these encampments and that students have been arrested, it's not just that you're driving around, but you see someone else has been pulled over on the side of the road. There is fair warning that the cops are out that day and you continue to speed. At some point, you have to make an adult judgment. The Vietnam protesters knew full well that they might get arrested. And in fact, if they got arrested and if they got expelled, they might be eligible for the draft. That was their personal decision as adults. And these young adults also now should face the same set of consequences, the same decision. For those who are saying, no, they should be able to do what they want, you are essentially arguing that on January 6th, most of the people who marched to the Capitol were just exercising their free speech. And the fact that a small proportion of those people were injuring police, were trespassing, were destroying property, were interfering with the transfer of power in America, and that they became cover for people who were there with criminal intent, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. That, you can't put that on everyone else. Yes, you can. Your right to loudly protest ends as soon as you trespass, as soon as you go too far, as soon as you break the law. I think what these encampments, what these protesters have shown is you've proven you can't be trusted to do this. As soon as you hold one of these protests, it's going to go too far. The universities are well within their rights to enforce their rules. And look, final thing I'll say to the students, what's your end goal here? What are you trying to achieve? If what you want is to make a martyr of yourself, to make a scene, to put yourself on display, great. We see you. Congratulations. If you want to actually accomplish something, how about trying to do it productively? Why are you protesting Columbia University? Why not protest companies? I don't think that they're particularly interested in affecting any change. I think they're interested in making martyrs of themselves and being on display.
I think they're absolutely just narcissists. I mean, look, these are the demands that they're making. Number one, anyone who's been arrested must be released and given amnesty, is their language. If you throw a bottle at a cop in the middle of a road in New York City, that's not amnesty.
Right. The J6 insurrectionists are hostages too, right?
I know, right. Do you all agree with that?
Thanks, Elise. Right. Yeah.
Oh my God. But so they're asking for their universities, at multiple universities, that they divest any investment that they have tied to an Israeli organization or company. So they literally want to wash their endowments of any connection to Jews. Let's think about that for a minute. That is what they're asking for. Let's think about that real hard for a minute. And then the other one is just
absurd. No, you're overthinking it there. You're overthinking. Too much thinking.
My God. And then, but for the record, I'm really fired up and I'm the one non-Jew on this podcast right now. It's ignorant what they're doing. And then the other one is just absurd. They are demanding that their various universities, this includes MIT, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and I'm not sure how many others, that they demand a ceasefire from Israel. Now, I want to understand this, young little narcissist of 22 years old in your elite little bubble world. Leaders of the world are trying to convince Netanyahu to back off. Military and government leaders of Israel's greatest ally, the United States of America, has publicly said, don't do what you plan to do next, which is go into Rafah. Because while there may be bad guys there, there are a lot of civilians there. That's where they're hiding out. Don't do that. And Netanyahu has said, my country will do whatever the hell I want. But little elite students, if MIT says, no, Netanyahu, we're now asking you to cease fire, he's going to go, everyone, arms down. MIT students who are calling for our genocide, tell us not to continue war. We'll be done now. The complete narcissism of that assumption boggles my mind. And to your point, Matt, these are the people that are supposed to be the brightest. They've been given life, many of them, on a silver platter.
You guys,
that's the bubble they're in.
Listen, I remember I was not the most mature student at the age of 16 or 17 when I went to college. And
given your pecker comments, I see that's changed considerably.
Oh, yeah. I'm not the most mature adult either. But these are for a lot of folks, their maturity is as yet to be attained. They're not really mature. The point of protests is not ever, at least in my experience, is rarely to be practical about it. There's a feel-good component about, oh, we're joining with our fellows to protest something that we want to, it makes us feel good to shout about it, because what else can we do? It doesn't work to write letters, so we're going to get out and show the world where we are and what we care about. So I don't think there's any, I don't ascribe any practical motives to people, and even the motives that they say they want are often impractical. We're now in a situation where pro-Palestinian protesters are being arrested all over the country. Emerson College, in Boston, campus protests, Texas, California, are being broken up. There are going to be consequences, including that the leadership of a lot of these universities that just don't get that they need to control their campus and they need to impose consequences. There's going to be consequences for the leadership, too. The sad thing in all of this is that the rabid, authoritarian, right-wing cabal that is governing Israel has fallen into the trap that Iran and Hamas created. It has now led to the conflation of Jews and the government of Israel in the minds of many people. The flare of anti-Semitism, which is always easily lit, has now been lit across the globe. Netanyahu has caused a response that Hamas predicted, has now lit the fire of anti-Semitism all over the globe. That is sad beyond measure, and it's squarely on Netanyahu. We grieve for the Jews who were killed, for the Israelis who were killed and taken hostage by Hamas. A barbaric, impossibly anti-human thing to do, right? And Netanyahu's response and his refusal to be in any way proportionate has caused damage for generations. So in that light, these protests are part of the damage. I lay it squarely at Netanyahu's feet. And most of the Israeli people apparently agree that Netanyahu has to go and has missed things.
Not really anything we can add to that. I want to just very briefly touch on first a good news story and then a hilarious story. The good news story is we previewed that it seemed like Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, was going to pull off the foreign aid bill, including the aid to Israel, to Taiwan, and to notably Ukraine. And he did it. He pulled it off. And it's remarkable. We suggested last week that, yes, there may be some politics involved, but still, I think the consensus of the group was he got it done. I don't have a lot to add to our comments personally from last week. I think we captured my sentiments pretty well. I just didn't want it to go unmarked that this is an historic accomplishment. Too damn late. There's been untold suffering in Ukraine because of the delay, and the delay was caused by Donald Trump as a puppet of Vladimir Putin. Let's be clear about that, but it did get done.
I just want to note that I happen to agree. I think Speaker Johnson did a very good job doing what he's supposed to do and getting it done. And to the extreme right-wing Republicans who think that Republicans working together with Democrats to get stuff done is somehow traitorous and not what the American people want, you couldn't be more wrong.
All right. On that note, let's get to the fun. We're going to play a game called Great Quote or the Greatest Quote Ever. Mitt Romney, former candidate for president on the Republican Party ticket and current Utah U.S. Senator for a little while longer anyway, had this to say when asked about the Trump hush money trial. I think everybody has made their own assessment of President Trump's character. And as far as I know, you don't pay someone $130,000 not to have sex with you. Now, the question I would have to both of you, first, the question I led with, great quote or greatest quote?
We got a long trial ahead. I'm going to stick with great quote right now because there could be more to come.
It's a very important statement.
And then I guess my next one is, would someone pay $130,000 not to have sex with Donald Trump?
I'd pay $1 million not to do that.
How much? What we're talking about here, this is a negotiation. How high would you go to not have to? I would top.
I think you should ask Melania this question, because I think that there's been a lot of consideration that's changed hands.
Is it possible? Oh, we're going too far. Okay, the new segment is called We're Going Too Far. Too far. The Saudi government did pay $2 billion to Jared Kushner. Is it possible that a portion of that was to not have sex with Donald Trump?
Maybe. Oh, my God. Okay, can we stop this show now?
All right. For Paul and Alicia, I'm Matt. We will see you next time.
I snorted on that one. That was funny. Hey.